Our gospel reading comes this morning from the Gospel of Luke, beginning with chapter 8 and reading verses 26 through 39. Hear now the words of the Lord. Then they arrived at the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite of Galilee, and he stepped out on land. A man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house but in tombs. When he saw Jesus, he fell down before him and shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it has seized him, and he was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would not break the bonds and be driven out by the demons into the wilds. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" He said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. They begged him not to order them to go back into the abyss. Now there on the hillside, a large herd of swine was feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter these, so he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When the swine herd saw what had happened, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then the people came out to see what had happened, and when they came to Jesus, they found the man whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told them how the one who had been possessed by demons had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." So he went away, proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. This is the gospel of the Lord. Praise to thee, O Christ. Today is one of those days when I wish I could sing, but I can't. But if I could, I would sing a verse or two from a popular song that was written in the 1980s by a group called The Clash. And the song, how many of you know of the song, "Should I Stay or Should I Go?" Oh, good. Maybe you can help me out here. Well, this song is actually the plea of one lover to another who's frustrated in their relationship. The singer laments, "One day is fine, the next is black." And then goes on to say, "If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, there will be double." I can visualize the prophet Elijah, boombox of the 80s, propped on one shoulder, trudging through the desert toward Oreb, toward Mount Sinai, singing this song over and over and over again, and wishing that God could hear his plea. And especially this first stanza of the song, and if you want to sing along, you can. And I'm just going to clap and mouth the words. But it says, "Darling, you gotta let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you gotta let me know. Should I stay or should I go?" That's right. It's the question that Elijah struggles with. It's the one that we often ask ourselves. Should I stay in this job or move on? Should I stay at this university or transfer to another? Should I stay in this relationship or leave? And what we really want to know is, God, what do you want me to do? Where is the best place for me? It's the question that Elijah and ultimately our healed demoniac friend in our gospel lesson ask
And it's our question as well. Actually, for today's purposes, I'd like to switch that around and say the question is, should I go or should I stay? Because in these two stories of of Elijah and of the demoniac, at the end of both stories, they are both given a commission. Elijah is said, given the commission to go. And the demoniac, who so wants to follow Jesus, is said, no, you need to stay here. The best place for you, the best job for you is here. So the prophet Elijah has found himself, as you've heard in the story, hiding out in a cave. His life seems to have gone out of control as he's fleeing for his life from the evil Jezebel, and he doesn't particularly want to leave his hideout. He has withdrawn from the world, pulled down the shades, and turned off the TV and tugged the covers over his head, and he's pretty happy there. But God says, you need to come outside, Elijah. And before he makes it to his cave, he's trekking through the Sinai desert. And I imagine Elijah wondering out loud, having this conversation with a God that he probably doesn't think is listening, and saying, God, how did I get here? Things started off so well, didn't it? You and I were such a good team. I was your man, and I did everything you wanted me to do. I called Israel's King Ahab on the carpet for marrying Jezebel. Wasn't he warned that she would bring idol worship, Baal worship, into Israel? Didn't I bring a drought on Israel because Ahab broke his covenant with you by joining the people of Israel in worshiping Baal? Didn't I show your people that you are the one true God when at Mount Carmel? Wasn't this a really good show, Lord, that we did together? When at Mount Carmel, the prophets of Baal couldn't bring fire down on their sacrifice on the altar. But you and I set up an altar, we put out the sacrifice, we put wood under it, we poured water all over it. And not only did your flames come down and consume it, when it was over, there was nothing left but a little pile of ash. That was really a great pyrotechnic display, wasn't it, Lord? And then your prophets who had abandoned you came back. And they eliminated Jezebel's prophets. And what do I get in return for all of that? I'm running for my life. So enough already. I quit. It reminds me of my daughter who, after a mostly successful first week in elementary school one year, was bullied on the playground one day. And so she came home a little dramatically and a little tearfully and said, Mom, I'm just not meant to be in second grade. Maybe she just thought she could skip on to third, I don't know. But she was certain of one thing, she wanted to quit. And it is in this spirit of stress and exhaustion and exaggeration induced by all of these things that Elijah says, maybe I'm just not meant to be a prophet, Lord. I think I'll just lay down in the scorching heat under this broom tree and take a nap and die. And don't we feel like Elijah sometimes? We've done all we're supposed to do, but our lives seem to be out of control. They're filled with the bullies of vocational concerns, of financial pressures, of broken relationships. They're filled with evil people who, like Ahab, have intellectually justified breaking covenant with us and breaking covenant with God and bringing evil into the world, bringing mass murders into Florida. And they rationalize their actions out of their own self-interest. Or like the demoniac in our story, which is really Elijah's story and our story too, we are oppressed sometimes by so many demons that we can't even count them. We're overwhelmed by this legion of voices raging at us from the inside and from the out, saying, perhaps you're not good enough. And our identity as a beloved child of God becomes denigrated to the point that we can be driven into places of loneliness and despair. And we ask, how did we get here? We just want to go hide in a cave. And when we do, when we let those voices overtake us,
we are distracted from the most important priority in our lives, our relationship with God.
Now, what I love about this text and what we learn from Elijah's story is that our God has deep compassion for God's children. And out of God's deep but unspoken compassion here, God supports us, supports Elijah in our wilderness places. Elijah, filled with exhaustion and self-pity and more than a little drama, basically tenders his resignation as a prophet and asks God to take his life. Now, did you wonder, like I did, if Elijah really wanted to die, why didn't he just stay in Jezebel's jurisdiction? Just a question. So exhausted, he lays down to sleep, and at some point, Elijah is startled not once but twice by a messenger of God telling him to get up and eat. And eat and drink from this hand-delivered divine meal. Otherwise, as Richard read, the journey will be too much for you. And at this point, we don't know what journey Elijah will be taking, only that it's going to require some divine sustenance. And what I think is impressive is that the angel doesn't chastise Elijah or make fun of him for being so whiny and dramatic. God is patient with Elijah's religious doubts and with his cheeky attitude. And thankfully, God is patient with ours as well. And what I love about God is that God knows, like a good parent, like a good father on this Father's Day, that sometimes in life, what his children need is just to take a nap. Sometimes they just need to stop and regroup and find rest for their souls and their bodies and divine sustenance to get them through the journey ahead. And sometimes that sustenance comes literally in the form of a hand-delivered meal, and sometimes it comes in the form of angels who just keep checking in on us and providing us with what we need most. How many of you, when maybe you had a new baby in the house, or just had the funeral of a loved one, or just came home from the hospital from a surgery, said to your friends, "We don't need any meals. Really, we don't need any meals." Anybody ever done that? And has anybody ever experienced that even though you said, "No, we don't need anything," you look up one day and in the midst of your grief or your exhaustion, your sleep deprivation, you find food on your doorstep that you didn't shop for, or chop, or prepare, or cook. It just magically appears. And you know in that moment, you've experienced it, have you? It is truly a gift of God, right? It is a gift of God. And so too are the hordes of friends who cleaned your house and mowed the yard when your spouse died. The friends who surrounded you and packed you up. The angels who helped you move after the disaster, or the ones who kept calling for 6 months after the breakup of the divorce. The angels who keep praying for healing, or for you to find a new job. God knows what we need for the journey ahead and is there providing sustenance out of his deep love and compassion, reminding us of our true identity as a child of God, reminding us that even in our wilderness places, we're not alone. Angels abound. But we can't stay locked up in our caves forever, and neither could Elijah. He needs to come out of his cave and listen to the voice of God. And so we find Elijah journeys 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Horeb, or Sinai as we know it, where Moses made his covenant with God. And at this point, Elijah's story is sounding a lot like Moses, isn't it? God provides bread from heaven, just as he did for the Hebrews when Moses leads them out of slavery in Egypt. For 40 years in the wilderness. Elijah's there 40 days and nights. And Elijah's cave is almost reminiscent of Moses' cleft in the rock where he sees the glory of God passing by. And so Elijah's sitting snugly in his cave and the Lord's voice comes to him and asks, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Now in Hebrew, the emphasis is on the word here. What are you doing here, Elijah? As if God is asking, shouldn't you be somewhere else, like maybe Israel? God doesn't seem particularly pleased to see Elijah. Or it could mean, "Why have you come to see me? What do you want from me, Elijah?" Either way, instead of answering the question directly, Elijah just says, as if God doesn't already know, "I have been very zealous for the Lord. I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts." And he pulls out the laundry list of crimes against the Israelites. They've forsaken God's covenant. They've torn down the altars. They've killed God's prophets. And then out of deep depression, he exaggerates the problem in a very dramatic way, saying, "And I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to destroy it." Elijah has conveniently forgotten that Obadiah is hiding 100 other prophets of Israel in a cave. Or he's forgotten about the people who converted at Mount Carmel and all the prophets who converted at Mount Carmel. And instead, he wants to play his boombox. He will not take up his prophetic mantle and put it around his shoulder. And I love God because he doesn't say enough of the whining already. The third time God speaks, it's not to ask a question, it's to say something. And he says, "Let me turn my boombox on for you. You need to get out of your cave because I'm about to pass by." And before Elijah steps foot outside the cave, God sends the great wind and the tornado and the earthquake and the fire, because those are the places we expect to see God in the Old Testament. God is present in those things, in these big shows of power, like Elijah has done at Mount Carmel. But instead, we find that God is not present in those. God is just announcing probably who he is in those. And then comes, after the fire, the sound of sheer silence. And it's awesome. Maybe this is what Elijah needs after all of his pomp and circumstance he's been doing. Just a little silence. And this brings him out of his cave, and God speaks and asks the same question, and he gets the same answer. "I've been so zealous. I've done all this stuff. There's nobody left but me." So God says, "I have an assignment for you, Elijah. I have an assignment for you. And it's one that is going to assure you that you're not the only one left doing God's work in Israel. I want you to go to Damascus. Go back. I want you to go. Go and anoint Hazael king over Aram, Jehu king over Israel. I want you to anoint your successor. Mentor him. Train him up. Bring up the next generation of church leaders. And it's these three who will finish the job that Elijah has started. He's not the only one doing the work of God, and he won't complete the work of God." Elijah's story teaches that God provides for us in our wilderness places, and that sometimes when life is overwhelming, we need to regroup and have some cave time. But after a time of nurturing, we have to get up out of the cave and go. We have to get up out of the cave and listen to God's voice and discern where God is calling us, and recommit and renew our commitment to get back to work. Because those of us who are baptized in the faith, God has a continuous call on our lives, and we don't get to quit. But we do find times to come before God and renew our commitment. And for those of you who are married, I know every time we go to a wedding and we hear vows recited by young couples, it reminds us of our commitment that we've made to one another. At every annual conference of the United Methodist Church, there's an ordination service where the bishop and other ministers lay hands on those who are being ordained. And I was privileged this year. I had 2 years ago requested that my orders be changed from that of deacon to elder, and it was requested. And so I thought I would just hand them my deacon's orders and I would get my elder's orders. But at this year, the bishop said, "No, I want you to be ordained again, because some of the vows of elder are a little different from deacon. And so we're going to do this service again for you, even though you've already been ordained." And it was a very moving experience. And I got to renew those vows as the bishop laid hands on and my family laid hands on and other ministers laid hands on. He said, among other words, "Take thou authority to teach and to preach and to administer the sacraments and order the life of the church, to to fight injustice wherever you see it, to fight evil wherever you see it. For those watching, it was a reminder that we have a job to do and we're not alone in that work. There's a whole cloud of witnesses helping us in that work. Dads, on this Father's Day, today is a day that you can renew your commitment to remember that parenting, like housework, is never finished. I have a dear friend who says, it's like stringing beads on a string with no knot in the end. But it's incredibly important work. And finally, what we learn through Elijah's experience is that there's a future beyond the cave, a great future. There's a future for Elijah and there's a future for Israel. Elijah accepts the renewal of his calling and he goes out and he anoints the two kings and he anoints Elijah. He anoints and mentors the next generation of church leaders. And there's a future for you as Cox Chapel congregation. As you've said farewell to your beloved minister, almost an Elijah figure, a great prophet, as you welcome one who literally the last week that Jeff was here placed his mantle on her, the newest minister to Cox Chapel, and as you continue the work of anointing and mentoring those who are called to lead the church in the future, you have a great job. There's a future for you as individuals, as you were called into God's service. So God asks today, why are you here? Maybe you just need to come to the table for some rest and nourishment and to reclaim your identity. Maybe you've already been in your cave too long, and perhaps you've been hiding out in church, and now you want to listen to what God wants you to do. And maybe God is calling you like he did the former demoniac, to stay among this community and tell the great things that God has done for you as a new generation hears how great God is. Or maybe God is calling you to go out into the world. So as you come today to the table, God invites you to take the bread of life, the supernatural food of God, to nourish you for the journey ahead, to come and find healing and hope. And so God asks you, as you come to the table, maybe you ask yourself, should I go or should I stay? Listen to God's voice as you come.